Thursday, October 3rd, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. And the jaw-dropping bombshell, bomb-dropping jawbreaker of a disclosure from Judge Tanya Chutkan neither dropped my jaw nor was a bomb. But it was dropped, and it was dropped somewhat unexpectedly, closer to an election than usual, but usual, what is usual with Donald Trump. What are we talking about here? Court filings consisting of Jack Smith's indictment of what he says Donald Trump's actions were in and around January 6th, the riots, his attempt, Donald Trump, the then president's attempt to hold on to power. Okay, the then president, but also the then losing candidate, wounded human being, man with a plan, and a loopy one at that. And that's important to say that, as Smith does, it wasn't all or any presidential actions that Smith is prosecuting. It's his actions in a non-presidential capacity, or perhaps even, yes, actions of the president, but not really core actions or actions that are, and this is important, not immune from prosecution. This is the entire reason that the filing exists, because Smith is trying to adhere to the Supreme Court's recent immunity ruling, which carves out a whole bunch of things that Donald Trump might have done as president, as the core actions of the president that would make him immune from this constitution. So he filed new pages, 135 new pages, following the new parameters of what's prosecutable. You know what it's like? You ever have to file a medical claim? Maybe like me, you had the bad insurance and some things were covered and some things weren't. So you thought something was covered and you did all the things with the forms that you usually do. And then it gets kicked back to you. And they say, you know, under H7 subsection 6, we don't cover whatever, amputations. So you rewrite it. You're like, all right, they're not going to cover an amputation. You try to argue, all right, I'm adhering to your rules. But now that you guys are covering Ozempic, don't think of it as an amputation. Think of it as weight loss. Limb-specific weight loss. Anyway, that's a little bit, great analogy, right? It really illuminated the situation. There are some new details in the filings. Like Trump says, it doesn't matter if you won or lost the election, you still have to fight like hell. And when told that Pence, Vice President Pence, is in danger, he says, so what? Steve Bannon shows up. He is named obliquely. He's person number one. We figured out it was him because the document says person number one, simultaneously wearing shirts number 1 through 5. But the details of what Bannon said, like Bannon saying, hey, Trump's going to declare victory no matter what, that was known, that was reported. And the identities of persons 1, not to mention 2 through 71, were also known. So much, there were details and a little bit of quotes, but so much of this was known, were in past filings as possibly prosecutable if there was no Supreme Court intervention defining and expanding the definition of immunity. There was also a big January 6th commission. Remember that? I do. Why was this treated as such a bombshell? Because the underlying actions were explosive? Trump trying to interfere with an election? Well, yes, but it was also known. When you know that the bomb has exploded and what the bomb was, you don't treat it as a bombshell. I think what's going on is, hey, look at that calendar. It's October, and we have this concept known as the October surprise. So we treat important stories, especially important stories, without entirely foreseen occurrences and components. We treat them in this category of October surprise. We perhaps elevate them. And Donald Trump is cunningly trying to have it both ways. He's campaigning on the idea that the federal government is out to get him. You know this. This is proof. And he uses it. He bolsters his credentials by arguing, and that's why you need me as a bulwark against government encroachment against the common man. So he's using it to his advantage, but he's also claiming victimhood by it, this thing that puts the wind beneath his wings. He claims that the filing itself is election interference. Interference, this indictment, which is basically his platform that they've come to indict me. Also, it's interference. I wish they wouldn't, except because they did, you need to vote for me. The bottom line, no trial can possibly happen within the next month. And if Trump wins, probably ever. Will he win? That is the subject of the show today, the full show. We bring on, we promise you, the experts. We have a great one, Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report. Cook itself not only analyzes the races, but they get out there and they pair with good pollsters and they do surveys. I will now read you the latest, a little hot off the presses, current margins in swing states. You ready? Wisconsin, Harris is up 2. Michigan, she's up 3. Arizona, she's up 2. Harris is up 1 in Nevada and Pennsylvania, and Trump is up 2 in Georgia. In other words, the current margin overall in the swing states, Harris is up 1. By contrast, I'll read you the Real Clear Politics polls. They're different from Cook. They maybe use different pollsters than other agglomerators of the polls. They have Harris up 0.8 in Wisconsin, tied in Pennsylvania, 0.7 in Michigan, and they have Trump up 1.7 in Arizona. They have Trump up 0.6 in North Carolina. They have Trump up 1.5 in Georgia. Let's say one of these services is totally correct. It means that someone is up, I don't know, 0.8 to 1.5. We're going to break it all down, how narrow this race really is, with Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report up next. Let's traipse through the states, and not all the states. I mean, 43 of them. Who cares? We're talking about the states that could decide the presidential election. I don't know. Maybe our traipserie will take us to Omaha and the 2nd Congressional District of Maine. Joining us as our guide and companion is Amy Walter, publisher and editor-in-chief of the Cook Political Report. Welcome back to The Gist, Amy.
Hi, Mike. I love both of those congressional districts. You've got Omaha is a lovely little city, and Maine 2nd Congressional District, you've got Acadia, you've got the end of the Appalachian Trail. There's a lot there, a lot to love.
It's non-coastal Maine. It's where Stephen King is from. He always says, I'm from the woods where it's scary. Are they voting for Trump?
Yes.
They are. Done.
Now, there's some
Done
coastal,
deal.
But you're right. It's not southern coastal. This is not Portland, Maine. Portland, Maine.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can divide Maine, like so many other states, into two distinct regions, or basically it's two states.
Right. So if Congressional District 2, where, by the way, the member of Congress from that district is Jared Golden. Is that
correct?
Right?
Correct.
And he's an interesting cat, because he was one of the first Democrats to say Joe Biden needs to get out, because he understands what his constituents are thinking. But it seems that he's a pretty good politician. He's suited to the district. He's a Democrat. So he could win. But Trump seems to be on a glide path towards victory there.
That's
all right.
Right.
Now, what about Omaha? Is that as certainly going Democrat as Maine 2 is going Republican in the presidential?
Yeah, it feels that way. And again, both of these districts, they really do embody the current state of our politics. The Omaha district, it was more Republican not that long ago, but like so many other suburban areas with a lot of white collar work, has moved further Democratic. And then Maine 2nd District, which was for years and years and years, this was labor Dems. The southern part of the state was, you know, those Brahmin Republican wealthier part of the state. And the northern part of the state was labor blue collar Dem. And that has flipped. So they represent the two Americas pretty well.
And another reason they represent the two Americas is just the landmass they occupy. So when people say, look at the map, look how red it is. I mean, look in Nebraska, it's going to be awash in red, and Nebraska will be red. But that congressional district is Omaha, and a little bit outside of Omaha.
That's right.
Then they have another congressional district sort of wrapping around that. And then they have the whole rest of the state. But every congressional district is 700,000 or so people, unless, say, you live in a state which doesn't get to two congressional districts and you have to be an at-large delegate in Wyoming representing a little more than most members of Congress represent. But you know what's good? It's like we're building. We took care of the one vote districts in the Electoral
but they're
College.
They're important. Hey,
they are.
They are. They could literally make the difference.
By the way, what do you think? Do you think I like them because they're quirky? And then I was trying to figure out, is that a sufficient reason in terms of civics to like a way to elect a president? Would it be good if other states were to do this for reasons other than quirk?
Boy, that is an excellent question. And it would be what I think you would find. In fact, if you look at just all the congressional districts in this country, we are pretty well sorted. There are only a handful of Democrats like Jared Golden who sit in a Republican area and only a handful of Republicans who sit in Democratic districts. So it would look a lot like where we are now, which is one side having 4 or 5 votes over 10 or 11 votes more. You know, if we did it by congressional district, 435 individual congressional districts instead of at large. But if you say do individual congressional districts plus, you know, you get 2 overall electoral votes for winning the state. I can't do that math that quickly, Mike, but I'll do that.
But it could be interesting. It could change things a little bit. I think we need to change because now we have, I don't know, sometimes they're called the blue wall. Are they blue? Are they a wall? 7 other states, which the general story with them is the polls seem to show in all of them, but you tell me if I'm wrong, except maybe Georgia, Harris having the slightest of leads in Michigan, Wisconsin, Arizona, Nevada, and Pennsylvania.
Again, depends on the time of day you're looking and which polls have been released. We just came out of the field with our own polling, Swing State Project polling, that we are doing in conjunction with, or actually the people doing the actual polling are real pollsters, Democratic pollsters, the Benenson Strategy Group, BSG, and Republican Group, GS Strategy. And what we found in that poll is, yes, exactly what you laid out, with Harris tied with Trump in North Carolina, Trump narrowly ahead in Georgia, and then Harris narrowly ahead. And when I say narrowly, we're talking about either a point or 2 points. I mean, this is all within the margin.
Right. And so I want to talk about that for a second. So from what I understand among people such as yourself and actual pollsters, it is a margin of error. That doesn't mean that it's not the case that it's more likely, if their poll is perfect, it's more likely that Harris does have the slight edge in a place that she's +1 than Trump actually has the edge. It's just, what's a way to think about that? They're not really standing by it. If Trump wins by 1, and there are other things other than an inaccurate poll, which could bring about that eventuality. But if Trump wins by 1, the pollsters would say, you know, we didn't really get that wrong, if you understand what margin of error.
That's right. And that's why I think appreciating what makes these states, again, 1 point leaning Trump versus 1 point leaning to Harris. And part of the reason that Trump is doing better in places like Georgia is that Harris, in the polling that we have right now, is not doing as well with Black voters as, say, Joe Biden did back in 2020. The margin that she has with Black voters in the state of Georgia is smaller. And that's a state where 30% of the vote is Black, and where pretty much the entire margin of victory for Democrats comes from being able to not just turn out those voters, but also run, you know, an 80 point surplus with them, something right in that category.
And I just want to be clear, she isn't doing as well as Joe Biden did in the 2020 election, but she is doing better, even in Georgia, with Black voters than Joe Biden was doing before he dropped out.
Yeah. I mean, let's be really, really clear. The whole reason this race is even a toss-up now is that Joe Biden is not on the top of the ticket. I mean, on average, she has built on Biden's numbers by about 6 points overall, if you just sort of push all of these swing states together. And yes, some of it is by increasing support with Black voters, with Latino voters, with, you know, pretty much all groups of voters, younger voters, but it's still not as robust as it was in 2020 for Biden.
Are there any key constituencies in the key states where she actually is doing better than 2020 Biden?
Yeah, I think that we are going to see her doing better with college voters. In fact, she is doing a little bit better with college voters, just in overall, if we look at national polling. And it won't, that wouldn't surprise me at all to see. And this is why...
But does that come with him doing better or Trump doing better with non-college
voters?
There
we go. So I look at a state like Pennsylvania and you go, why is Pennsylvania always so close? It's that, you know, for the last two cycles, what's happened is for every, let's say, you know, suburban voter that the Democratic nominee gets, Republicans are going to get a rural voter that used to be Democrat, right? So it's like they're trading each other's constituencies. And it's just a question of two things. One, just how much of a turnout is there? And this has been a challenge for Democrats now, going back even pre-Trump. But the city of Philadelphia used to be just a great vote generator for Democrats. Mm-hmm. And it's not as robust of a city. It's a smaller footprint now than it did, say, 20 or 30 years ago. But its share of the vote is going down because folks are just not turning out at the same level that they did. And that alone is costing Democrats a lot of votes. And you combine that with Republican success in winning over in some of these parts of Philadelphia, especially in heavily Latino parts of Philadelphia or outside Philadelphia, Donald Trump doing okay. I mean, not great, but again, it's just peeling off little pieces of the other side's coalition enough so that you win by 60, 80,000 votes.
Yeah. And Philadelphia lost, I think, since 2020, 53,000 residents or 3% of its population. Yeah. If you're talking about peeling off a little bit, that's part of it.
That's a big deal. Yeah.
Most population loss is in the very gentle category of voters aging out of the electorate, which is the nice way of saying they're dying. And that does favor Democrats. But in places like I think Pennsylvania is the oldest state. And in places like Philadelphia, that's running in the opposite direction, you're saying.
Yeah, and where you've got a lot of younger voters, but are they engaged enough to show up?
So I've been listening to your podcast called, oddly, The Odd Years, because I think it started in an
odd year. And now everything's
now
odd. Why change it? Because everything
that's right.
is
it
odd.
Is, we are in the odd years. And there was an episode before Biden dropped out. And this is exactly what we were just talking about, the lack of enthusiasm among the youth, or question marks among the youth. And all the polling then, all your discussion then before Biden dropped out, and there was pressure, but the debate hadn't happened, was, look, this is a huge problem for Democrats. The youth are they're telling the pollsters they're very unexcited by Biden. It's a big problem. Now we wipe that clean. We swipe, I don't know if it's left or right, I'm married. we swipe it away, and the problem is still there. At the time, it seemed like Joe Biden was the problem, but that problem with unexcited youth, even with Vibey Brett, Kamala Harris, is still there, I guess, to a lesser extent.
Right.
But what does that tell us? That really is a problem, or that the youth are going to say something's a problem, and then you take that away and like, okay, maybe my real problem was something else. I just don't like voting.
These are all excellent questions that I don't know that I have a perfect answer. One thing that I think is important to appreciate about the switching out and its impact on the younger voters. You're right. I can't remember right now off the top of my head the increase in young vote that Harris has gotten over Biden, but it is significant. At the same time, you know, these younger voters are less politically engaged than the more traditional voter. Let's call them the middle-aged voter. someone who's not been aged out of the of the voting pool. But so they also are kind of like, who is this person? They don't have much of an understanding of her. So they also need to feel more comfortable and in understanding who this person is. They're also going to be much more sensitive to issues like inflation. And, you know, we looked at the poll we just came out with earlier this week. The question on, do you think the economy is getting better or worse? Do you think inflation is getting better or worse? And younger voters are so much more pessimistic than the electorate as a whole. And I think there are a number of reasons for that. You know, if you're younger, your cost of living is taking up a very significant chunk of whatever disposable income you have. And what, whether that cost of living is how much you're paying for gas, what housing costs, maybe it's a healthcare issue, but this is kind of a day-to-day concern that older voters who maybe have more of a nest egg or have more stable job, have a home that there's already that they already live in, paying a mortgage, et cetera. So I do think that that inflation thing is a piece of it. Not knowing Harris all that well is another piece of it. And then I think we're going to find out, well, actually, let me do one more thing. There's been some evidence, and there's going to be a debate for the next month and then after that, about a gender gap within this younger cohort of voters. New York Times found this huge gap between how younger women are identifying as more liberal and younger men are not as liberal. And that this gender gap is also what's causing some of that lack of consolidation for Harris among younger voters.
Yeah. By the way, of the gender gap, which the New York Times has redubbed the gender gulf, when we talk about Harris not having as strong a support in the Black community, and we didn't mention it, but it's mostly among Black men as opposed to Black women, compared to Biden in 2020, shouldn't we be seeing, or are we seeing an uptick among women voters of all ages just because of the Dobbs decision? Are the polls picking that up, and shouldn't that be giving her a tailwind?
Looking at our overall sample of swing state polling, she is doing much better. So I'll give you an example. Among Black women, so this is in all the swing states, she's winning them by more than 70 points, but winning Black men by close to, like, say, 45 points. Huh, right? So that's a pretty big gap. But there was also a pretty big gap in 2020 in terms of Black women and Black men. And so in Georgia, for example, Biden won Black women by 85 points. He won Black men by 67 points. Here's the big difference. Guess who turned out? Black women were 17% of the electorate. Black men were 11% of the electorate. And so we have to, I'm trying to write something about this too, but understanding turnout, and this is what nobody really, really knows, right? How many of these people are actually going to show up? Now, we know that if you voted consistently, if you showed up in the last four elections, you're showing up in this election. Unless you have aged out. If you haven't shown up, maybe you will, maybe you won't. All that to say is, just traditionally, women do turn out at a higher number than men do. And that's why the gap is important to look at in terms of what percent voting for Harris, what percent for Trump. But how many of these people actually show up matters too.
Yeah. By the way, in, say, the 2008 or 2012 election where Black turnout spiked and there was a lot of enthusiasm for Barack Obama, was there that turnout gap that you pointed to in Georgia? Do Black women historically turn out a lot more than Black men?
I would suspect that women are, just overall, if you look, you know, the percent of the electorate that turns out nationally, women are going to be like 52, sometimes 53%. But that's a good thing to go back to. I'll go look back at 2008, 2012. Remember, 2012 was the first time in history that Black turnout, in terms of a the percent of eligible voters turned out was higher than white turnout.
Yes.
So that was also significant. So even if more women turned out than men, so many more turned out overall, right? That had a big impact.
And we'll be back in a minute with Amy Walter. We'll also talk about some Senate races. Stay tuned for that. Amy Walter is the editor-in-chief and the publisher of the Cook Political Report. And so let us continue our reporting on politics. I want to ask about Senate races. Democrats are outperforming Kamala Harris, which isn't necessarily an indictment of Kamala Harris, but they have no leeway in order to maintain a 50-50 grip on the Senate. How is it looking and what states are slipping away from them? Montana, I'm thinking of, but you tell me if anything else is maybe moving towards their column.
That's right. You know, this is really the control of Senate goes through basically Montana and Ohio. And right now, both of which are held by Democrats. And right now, Tester in Montana, the Democratic senator, is trailing in polling. This is a really red state. And Tester has his brand, I think, is a very strong one there. He's been able to hold on despite the fact that it's a Republican leaning state. But this year, a number of factors just, I think, are working against him. The first is that it's a presidential year. And so turnout is going to be much higher than he first ran and won in 2006.
Yeah. Which usually means states revert more to their nature.
That's right. And to the Republicanism, the people who are turning out are going to be. And, you know, the other thing that is, he's got a much stronger opponent than any previous opponent that he's had. He's both stronger as a candidate, but also better funded candidate than he's seen before. And finally, you know, Montana's obviously growing pretty fast. It now has two congressional districts once again because of its population growth. But it also means that states like Montana are not as it has kind of washed the parochialness out of the state. So, you know, when there were times when you could be a Montana Democrat and people in the state knew what that meant. Right? That, mm-hmm. Yeah, this isn't a national day. He's a Montana Democrat. So I'm going to vote Republican for president. I'm going to vote Republican on these things. But I'm going to vote for my guy. He's a Montana kind of Democrat. Well, it's really not there in the same way anymore. And so it's harder to distinguish yourself from the national brand. So just to do the math very quickly, if that seat flips, we know West Virginia is going to flip Republican. That's 51-49 in favor of Republicans. So that's, there we go. Regardless of who wins the White House, Republicans have the Senate, which is why there's now so much attention on Texas, because where can you make up for a loss? If you're Democrats, you got to go look at what are your offensive opportunities. And Texas and Florida are really the only two marginally competitive states that Republicans are defending. Now, Texas, for years, how many years has it been, Mike? Like, as long as I can remember, this is the year Texas is flipping. This is the year Texas is flipping. And it is. And remember, Texas was closer in terms of the presidential vote than Ohio was. You know, Trump wins Texas by 5-6 points. He's going to win Ohio by 8-10 points. So it is, even though it's a bigger state, it is a monumental task moving 2 or 3 points in a state like Texas, because that's millions of votes that you're trying to move, which costs zillions of dollars. But Colin Allred has put this state in play, and who's the Democratic candidate? This is Ted Cruz. It's easy to raise money if you're a Democrat running against Ted Cruz, because people around the country want to write checks to you because he's that polarizing. So if Democrats get a big upset, then you're back to a 50-50 Senate, and who wins the White House matters. But then we go to Ohio.
Oh, I just want to interrupt to give you the fact that Texas hasn't elected a Democrat statewide since 1994. I think Bob Bullock was the last. And this is not just, you mean governor, lieutenant governor? Keep going. Attorney general, right. Senator, right. All members of the county boards. Oh, my gosh. Railroad commissioner, right. Yeah. Hundreds and hundreds of, okay, maybe not hundreds and hundreds, but well over 100 races have gone to the Republicans in Texas since the last time a Democrat won.
That's
just
right.
Just putting that out there.
No. It's going to have to be a different kind of Democrat. So I think back to those era, the 80s, 70s era Democrats, those were conservative yellow dog Democrats. Those folks are now Republicans, right? That kind of voter is now officially a Republican. The people who are turning Texas blue are people who are moving into or have lived in and around Dallas, Houston, Austin, San Antonio, the suburbs, which used to be dark red, and the eastern part of the state, the more rural parts of the state were dark blue. Now what you're seeing, and it takes a long time in a state this big, but that the vote is not going to come from the places it used to come from for Democrats. It's going to come from the places that are now fast growing suburban areas. It's just not there yet.
Yeah. And Ohio?
And Ohio then becomes critically important. If, let's just assume we did both of those. We did a double flip, Texas and Montana. Now we come to Ohio and you say, all right, Sherrod Brown's ahead in polling. To your point, he's significantly outpolling Harris here. But it is a state that Trump will win 9 points, maybe more. And overcoming that deficit is really, really, really hard. You know, you can overcome 3 point, 4 point, 5 points. Now you're getting into some really challenging territory because you're the only place where you're seeing significant ticket splitting is North Carolina, where the gubernatorial Republican has basically collapsed in terms of support. And the Democratic candidate is now, at least in our polling, getting over 20% of Trump voters are voting for the Democratic candidate for governor.
Yeah. Has that ever really hurt the guy at the top of the ticket when the guy underneath implodes?
No, because this is what's happening right now. Trump is tied in North Carolina with Harris, even as the Democratic candidate for governor is ahead by more than 20 points. Because the Democratic candidate for governor is getting a whole bunch of people who are like, yeah, I'm voting for Donald Trump. And I'm also voting for the Democrat for governor, not because I like Democrats, but because there's no way I can vote for this governor candidate.
So here's my last question. Do both presidential campaigns strike you as running as if this race is as close as it is? Are they behaving like campaigns that are within 1 point of winning or losing?
So, Mike, this has been the question, I think, since the moment Donald Trump entered the political arena as a serious candidate in 2015. This is what's so fascinating about where we are, because, again, how many political campaigns have we heard about suburban women? You got to get the women. You got to win over women. You can't alienate women voters. You can't alienate independent voters. He does alienate them, but his success in turning out people who are not traditionally interested in politics or involved in politics, who've been sitting on the sidelines for years, maybe never tuned into politics, has helped him overcome the dislike or distrust or whatever we're going to call it from traditional voters. So I'll just give you an example. When we broke the electorate into three buckets, one being people who voted in four of the last four elections, so-called super voters. These are the kinds of people, these are your civic-minded, institutional-supporting kind of voters, right? And they're also really pretty partisan because they know they're blue or red. But these are the people you know that show up in every election. It's my civic duty, blah, blah, blah. They give Kamala Harris a four-point advantage. They actually, even before Biden dropped out in our polling in May, when Biden was struggling overall, he was winning those voters by 4 points. When you get into the next group of voters, that next chunk, which are the 30-something percent that don't vote in every election, that are sporadic voters, that's where Trump gets his lead. And in some cases, it's been as big as 10 points. Right now, it's closer. I think we have it at 5 or 6 points. Those voters, again, traditionally, they were not considered target voters because campaigns would be like, well, how do we know they're going to turn out? I don't want to spend a whole lot of money targeting this group of voters who they never turn out anyway. And they didn't turn out in part because they don't like politics, but they like Donald Trump. And that's what makes his campaign so, so different than anything we've ever seen. Meanwhile, the Harris campaign is doing everything that a traditional campaign would be doing. And doing,
I think I'm probably obliged as a member of the mainstream national media to say, what about more interviews on ABC, NBC, yes, CBS?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, whatever. You know,
that's her analysis.
She can do it. She can do it. Yeah. She can not do it. I don't know that it's going to help her with the people that she needs to get. If the people she needs to win over, they are not the people who are reading the New York Times right now.
Right.
They don't
right.
care that the local newspaper has endorsed you, or, you know, this opinion writer thinks you're doing awesome, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't care. What are you gonna do for me? And so I think it's been, again, this is where her campaign has been very, very smart. While the chatter among, again, the pundit class is not just, are you going to go and talk, sit down with more journalists, but, oh, she is, you know, she needs to talk about January 6th. She needs to talk about democracy being on the line. She needs to talk about the importance of, you know, the winning over these former Republicans. It's like, no, she needs to win among people who really are asking the question of, what is this going to mean for me, for my family tomorrow and the next week?
All right. Amy Walter is the political analyst who is behind, in fact, more than behind, she leads. She's from the front. She's the editor-in-chief and publisher of the Cook Political Report. Thank you so much, Amy.
Thank you, Mike. It's always a good conversation.
That's it for today's show. Joel Patterson is the senior producer of The Gist. Corey Warr is the producer. Leo Baum is our intern. Tomorrow, we air Funny You Should Mention, our series where I talk to comedians about their ideas as theses. You know, theses, kind of a funny word, but you don't want to be too on the nose about it. Michelle Pesca is the CBSO of Peachfish Productions. To advertise, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Oompuru, gee, puru, doo, puru. Thanks for listening.